This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 20th of July 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, US Defence Secretary Ash Carter heads to Israel to ease its concerns over the Iran nuclear deal. Then, here in the UK, Prime Minister David Cameron announces a new five-year plan to fight terrorism in the country.
We're now going to actively encourage the reforming and moderate Muslim voices. This is a significant shift in government approach.
Sebastian Borger and John Everard will be here to give us their views and analysis. We'll also be looking at Greece, of course, and ask what impact the crisis has had on anti-EU sentiment across Europe. And as the flags are raised outside new embassies in Havana and Washington, D.C., we discuss the issues that remain unresolved between two old enemies. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, on Monocle 24. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are John Everard and Sebastian Borger. Sebastian is the London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung, and John is a former British diplomat who served in Belarus, Uruguay and North Korea. US Defence Secretary Ash Carter has arrived in Israel for the first cabinet-level US visit since the announcement of the Iran nuclear deal last week. Israel is, of course, very much against the deal. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has called it a stunning historic mistake that will not prevent Iran from gaining nuclear weapons capability. Mr. Carter has now tried to calm him down. Just before landing in Tel Aviv, he announced that military action could still be used to prevent Iran from developing a nuclear bomb. And according to the US defence chief, the deal is a good one because it does nothing to prevent the military option. John Everard, there is now a lot of soothing and hopefully calming of nerves, the US hopes, in Tel Aviv, because the US certainly wants to keep Israel on side.
Yes, but at the same time, Ash Carter prefaced his visit by saying he was not going to change minds in Israel, a refreshingly honest comment. I think the remark about the remaining possibility of a military strike was calculated, yes, of course, to soothe Israel, but also to simply state the obvious. Of course, that remains on the table. Both Israel and the United States retain its capability. And I think it was significant that the Iranian response was carefully worded and very muted, saying this wasn't a real option and it was sad that people were still saying this, which is a kind of the minimum I think that Iran felt it could say under the circumstances. I thought more interesting than anything on all this was Bibi and Netanyahu's remarks about the timing of the deal, saying that if Iran doesn't cheat Hizbu, that it might well stop Iran from getting bombs in the next few years, but it will get a lot of bombs in a decade or so. That is the time frame in which he's thinking. And this leaves me wondering whether there is an unspoken narrative here. I am old enough to remember when Iran was a staunch US ally. And I remember at that time that Israel and Iran bickered all the time because, of course, Israel was at that time not the only show in town. And there were competitors for US favors. Now, we can all see that Iran is slowly changing. We can all see that the arrival of Islamic State has changed the game. All of a sudden, Hezbollah looks almost sane in comparison. At least you can
only just.
Only just. Okay, but you note the relative lack of rhetoric on Hezbollah. And I think one of the acid tests here is whether Iran, as part of the side flurries of this deal, manages to restrain Hezbollah, and whether we see any more, for example, rocket attacks on Israel. It'll be one to watch.
Sebastian Borger, I mean, on that point from John, it does have the potential to change the dynamic somewhat in the Middle East, because, of course, it's not just Israel, which has been a staunch ally of the US, but also Saudi Arabia has been a staunch ally of the US over the last three or four decades. And that is something that may be slightly sort of shaken up by this Iran deal.
Now, it's an absolutely fascinating strategic game, and so good to have a former ambassador on the program to talk about that, because obviously the Saudis feel threatened by this, by Iran now coming back in from the cold and being a serious player, and hopefully being a player who the West can make deals with on all sorts of other fronts. John mentioned Hezbollah. We've got to talk about Syria, Iraq. We've got to talk about Yemen. You know, it's a very important deal, and we haven't seen half of the fallout yet.
Oh, one big bit of fallout. I'm so glad you mentioned Saudi. I think is going to be focus on the Saudi nuclear program, which of course nobody's talked about because Saudi's always been in American eyes on the side of the angels. Now that the ground has shifted, you know, how much further tolerance is it going to be for what Saudi's been doing?
Sebastian, the other big thing that Ash Carter will be doing in Tel Aviv is trying to prevent Benjamin Netanyahu from being too enthusiastic in his lobbying back in America against the deal, because Netanyahu will know that the Republicans in Senate will obviously vote against it, but he will be trying to make sure that some of the Senate Democrats, who have been quite hawkish, some of them, on Iran in the past, will perhaps vote against this deal. And Mr. Netanyahu has proven in the past that he has no problem in, as some people would describe it, interfering in American domestic politics.
We'd love to be a fly on the wall in those talks, wouldn't we? Very interesting whether Bibi Netanyahu will give way to pressure from the Obama administration, which of course has a much shorter shelf life than his own government, only recently re-elected. On the other hand, he's whatever you think of his politics, he's a very clever man who thinks long term and strategically, and he must reckon with the possibility that even the next president might not be one of his friends in the Republican Party. He'll have to live with whoever gets elected in America. And I think there is a danger of him overreaching his lobbying in Washington.
I agree with all of that. And I'd add that, of course, this deal has been a decade in the making. And everybody's had all the time they needed to prepare positions on the Hill. And I'm sure that the effects of Bibi's inevitable lobbying against the deal have already been heavily discounted, that the administration will have its ducks in a row on that.
And do you think then on this point that everyone is essentially going to go through the motions, that Netanyahu will try and lobby people on the Hill and say, you must vote against it. Some of them will, some of them won't, but it will still all go through. And therefore, you know, Obama gets his deal. Netanyahu gets to show people at home that he's stood up for Israel. And we kind of get to bumble along.
Yes, I think that is very exactly what's going to happen. And I think the numbers have been run very carefully in back rooms for a very long time.
Sebastian, there was a piece in The Onion recently which said after Iran deal, US sells lots of weapons to Israel. There was a piece I saw earlier this week, not in The Onion, which suggested that might actually be true. I mean, this is going to be one of the consequences, isn't it, of this deal, is that, you know, Israel will ask for more weapons, and America will think, well, yeah, why not?
We fully expect Russia and China selling all sorts of weapons to Iran very soon. So why shouldn't America sell a few weapons to Israel? Yes, I mean, that's that goes without saying. Not that the region needs any more weapons, but there we are.
Yes, I think in particular Israel will ask for the enhancement of Iron Dome that it's been talking about for a while, and for the largest American bunker buster bomb that the Americans have so far withheld. Those are going to be the two big asks.
Okay, let's move on now to here in the UK, where Prime Minister David Cameron has announced today a new five-year plan to fight terrorism. In his speech, he said that Britain must act to de-glamorise groups like Islamic State, and it should do more to promote tolerance, democracy, the rule of law, and freedom of speech. The new measures include allowing parents to have their children's passports cancelled if they suspect them of planning to join a radical group abroad, and new powers to tackle foreign channels promoting messages of hate and extremist content. John Everard, is there an element here of a prime minister looking to, trying to look busy and trying to do things to give the impression that he's definitely serious about this.
Yes, I think there is an element of that. But at the same time, it was a very carefully worded and very well delivered speech. I mean, it was a very clear message both to the Islamists and to anybody who might have dealings with them that Cameron is serious about stopping this. In many ways, he simply has repackaged already available measures into a rather grandiose five-year plan. Why 5 years? Why not 10? Why not 15? Anyway, five-year plan to tackle the scourge. One interesting tidbit is that, as you say, he has said that parents will be able to ask for their children's passport to be cancelled. This is an obscure British constitutional weakness. There is no constitutional guarantee in the United Kingdom of the right to a passport, which means that in certain circumstances, the government can cancel it. Now, you can see that this is the kind of...
Why leave it to the parents? I didn't quite get that.
No, I thought that was odd too. If, for example, the security authorities believe that a child is in danger of running off and joining Islamic State, why can't they step in? But that wasn't actually in the speech. Curious, I agree.
It sounded positively Soviet, didn't it? All this talk of a five-year plan, very, very, very odd. I completely agree with John. It was a very carefully worded speech. The background was one nation, one United Kingdom, which is interesting because, of course, it quotes his own election campaign. But the measures that he talked about seemed to me slightly sort of plucked out of thin air. I mean, he's saying, on the one hand, rightly, I believe, that there are too many kids from actually quite well-to-do families who have had the chance to go to university and get a degree at a UK university, and then go off and fight for Daesh, ISIL, whatever you want to call it. On the other hand, he's asking a senior civil servant for help, whose speciality is dealing with what is called problem families. In other words, where generations have been on the dole. It doesn't quite fit together.
John, is there also an issue about how this looks, in that we're talking about a prime minister from a very posh, comfortable white background, who leads a government which has no Muslims in it whatsoever, where the only Muslim who's actually been in a David Cameron cabinet, Saeed Avasi, has actually said, I disagree with everything he's doing here. There's a danger in how this looks, isn't there?
Can I just say the business secretary, Sajid Javid, is a Muslim, isn't he?
Okay, I take that back.
Yes.
One out of 23.
Yes, thank you. How does it look? Yes, of course, there has been some dissent in his own ranks. What has struck me was the extent to which his remarks have been endorsed by the left in the UK. If you troll through the comments on it in left-wing newspapers in this country, people who have never, as far as I'm aware, ever said anything nice about David Cameron are coming out saying, this was an awesome speech. The themes plucked from the air, you think, Sebastian? I think he's very carefully picked the ones that he knows are going to appeal.
He can deliver.
He can deliver, yes, point one. Point two, that are going to command assent across the political spectrum. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of internal politics in this, and he's pitched it just right.
Don't you think the interesting thing, I thought, if you turned the sound off, if you just looked at the speech, it could have been Tony Blair's.
Yes.
He's completely copying Tony Blair in the way he talks about the Iraq war. He talks about he rejects all this talk of the Jewish conspiracy. He says it wasn't our foreign policy, 9/11 happened before the Iraq war, all of those things. We all heard that from Tony Blair. Okay. I think my feeling was the security services are very nervous. I think that's part of the problem. I think he wants to stand up and say, I've got this problem under scrutiny in case there is another attack.
We don't need to speculate. When the security services have just a couple of weeks ago raised the terror alert.
Right. Sebastian, from a German perspective, and when you sort of look across Europe, this is obviously something that all Western European countries are having to deal with, and they're all dealing with it in different ways. In Denmark, for example, you have this program where actually people that have come back from Syria are being reintegrated back into society, and they're trying to deal with it in certain ways. In Germany, obviously, there's been both the Pegida movement and the very, very strong anti-Pegida movement. How do you judge what David Cameron's doing here compared to elsewhere in Europe?
Well, I think you have to say, of course, we just 10 days ago had the 10th anniversary of the 7/7 bombings on London tube trains. We in Germany, fortunately, haven't had an attack like that. So we, to some extent, I think we are looking at countries like Britain and France with very big Muslim minorities and a history of terrorist attacks. How do they deal with it? There's tremendous interest in Germany. And of course, I think we are slightly lagging behind in the way we talk. At least it is talked openly about here in Britain much more than it is in my country.
Yeah. John, do you think that, as Sebastian was saying, there were echoes of Tony Blair. And I think back to Tony Blair's speeches after 7th of July, where he said very grandiosely, the rules of the game have changed, which seems to be the very opposite of what we're always told about terrorist attacks, which was we shouldn't change our way of life because that way the terrorists win. This struck me as a bit more, less like he was trying to make a big statement of this is a big generational war.
Yes, the fact that he calls it a five-year plan indicates that he thinks this is going to go on for quite some time. As I said at the beginning, I said that 5 years was a conservative estimate. Have the rules of the game changed? Essentially, no. He's pointed to existing powers. He's ramped up a few other powers, but nothing really game-changing in there. Just very good presentation.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Sebastian Borger and John Everard, thank you both very much. We'll be back in a moment talking about the impact that Greece has had on anti-EU sentiment across Europe. Plus, we'll be discussing Cuba and America. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
Monocle's unrivaled network of editors and correspondents around the world bring you a brilliant new collection of books, The Monocle Travel Guides. Speaking in an informed but informal way about everything from architecture to art, late night bars to early morning markets, the Monocle Travel Guides mix the classic with the contemporary, going beyond the conventional and revealing the hidden spots that cities have to offer. Published by Gestalten, these travel guides are for people who want to get the most out of their stay, however short, and feel like locals rather than tourists in the world's great cities. These series kicks off with London and New York, available now in Monocle shops, at monocle.com, and in all good bookstores. And watch out for Hong Kong and Tokyo on the way soon. The Monocle Travel Guides. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
How do Europe's business leaders start their day?
Everyone's seeing the possibility of what reforms could do to unleash the power of the Indian economy is really exciting.
Who tracks the stories that really matter like no one else?
You're going to take so much money out of the Greek economy that they can't possibly generate growth. You have to manage a transition to a more private-oriented economy.
Where can you have a real conversation to kickstart your working day?
You don't mean the referendum on gay marriage, do you?
I don't. Which is coming up. Surprising.
Very interesting. And the International New York Times has a piece. They assume that it will be passed. Mm-hmm.
The answer to all these questions is The Globalist on Monocle 24. Weekdays at 9 a.m. in Istanbul and 7 a.m. in London.
That Sebastian Borger gets around, doesn't he? He's on The Globalist as well. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with the star of Monocle 24, Sebastian Borger, and also John Everard. Now, in Greece, banks have finally reopened this morning, having been closed for 3 weeks. However, there are still capital controls, a €420 limit on weekly withdrawals. Greeks have also faced price rises as an increase in value-added tax came into effect today. It is, of course, all part of the bailout deal that the country reached with international creditors last week. The impact of that crisis is, of course, being felt across Europe. and it has given a boost to anti-EU parties. In Germany, a new Eurosceptic party, ALFA, the Alliance for Progress and Renewal, has been launched. While in Finland, one of the nation's most experienced politicians, Paavo Väyrynen, an MEP and a former presidential candidate, is campaigning for a referendum on the Eurozone membership. Sebastian, let's begin with Germany and ALFA. This new group, it's already split off from the Alternative for Deutschland. Always good when a small splinter party splits into two. But this is the less crazy half.
The sane part, yes. Yes. Well, I would argue that, but, you know. Exactly. I mean, I'm not entirely sure whether we can talk about a boost for Eurosceptic parties, because this is a very German process where this Eurosceptic movement, which was quite strong, you know, it was founded in the spring of 2013. In September, at the Bundestag elections, they almost got in. They had almost 5%, and they of course had a more than 10% at the European elections last year. But of course they fell out on particularly economic questions, interestingly. The new party now is the Party of the Economic Liberals, presumably. That's why they're calling themselves after an Italian car brand.
The Ferrari party.
The Alfa Romeo party. The others are the ones who are really fishing in rather unsavory nationalist waters.
I mean, is there the hope for this new party, for those that are in it, that this can be a more serious alternative, to use that word, rather than one that ends up getting a little bit too far righty?
I think there are two possible outcomes here. One is, this is a vanity project of Bernd Lucke, the former party leader of Alternative for Germany, who's now founded this new party, and it'll fizzle out within a year or so. Or he could, because he's got a core of people, clever people and renowned people in Germany of the sort of right of the political spectrum around him, he could possibly peel off some conservatives who, of course, are increasingly disenchanted with what Angela Merkel is doing as Chancellor.
And John, of course, you know, across the Nordic nations, but particularly in Finland, there has been... Finland has been standing shoulder to shoulder with Germany, as it were, in being quite forthright about what it feels should be done with Greece. It is then perhaps not surprising that we have, you know, a very prominent politician in Paavo Väyrynen and you know, campaigning for a referendum, saying that maybe Eurozone membership isn't quite right for Finland.
Well, no, it's not surprising at all. Firstly, we had to remember that in 1994, when the Finns had their initial referendum on whether to join the EU, it was only 56% in favour. I mean, it was not exactly a slam dunk, you know, huge majority. And I think there are open questions over how far that's eroded over the past years. The other point is that Finland is in an unusual position because it is the only Nordic country that has the euro. Of course, Sweden and Denmark never adopted it. Norway is not...
Had a referendum themselves in 2003 and voted not to adopt the euro.
Yes, indeed, that's right.
Let's not forget the Baltic states, though, because they are actually now a member of the eurozone as well. So
yes, that's right.
And there are very close links with Finland, of course.
Yes, you're quite right. If you bring the Baltics,
but for other political historical reasons, they're far more pro-European and far more pro the euro, though.
Well, you know, they can see someone else on their borders who they're very unhappy with, namely Vladimir Putin's Russia.
Yeah, yes. They're more worried about Russia than they are about Greece.
Fair enough.
But I think more generally, this is just part of a Europe-wide, or at least Northern Europe-wide phenomenon of irritation at the way the EU has behaved over recent years. And Greece has been the catalyst that has brought all this out. Reasonably well-run, reasonably prosperous Northern European countries are increasingly being fed up, getting fed up with
pumping money into profligate, badly run southern European ones, in broad terms. And so you get this EU split. You get, you know, movement like Pegida in Germany. You've got the phenomena that talked about in Finland. You've got the Hungarians also in the middle.
The Dutch, the Belgians, of course.
That's right. The list goes on. And let's not even mention the UK. But on the one hand, all saying, you know, we're very uncomfortable with this, that we are not in favour, effectively, of ever closer union. And in southern Europe, you've got the kind of counterpart, most stridently articulated by Greece, but with voices also echoing across southern Europe, complaining about the way that northern Europeans effectively have the temerity to ask for their money back over long periods of time. And, you know, this is starting to feel quite uncomfortable. I think that when Tusk said that this was one of the biggest crises in the EU's history, that was no exaggeration.
Okay, finally, diplomatic relations between the US and Cuba have now been officially restored. As today, the diplomatic missions of the countries became full embassies. Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez visited Washington, D.C. for the first time in his life and raised his country's flag at the new embassy. Despite this happening today, there are, of course, still a number of issues that remain to be solved. Sebastian Borger, it's certainly symbolic, and perhaps it's one of those things that, because we've known it's been coming for several months, it's been quite easy to feel slightly blasé about it today, as in, oh well, it's happening and we knew it was going to happen. But this is quite a major step.
Don't you think it's fascinating? We've looked at Obama's presidency for 6 years now, and we said, oh God, what a disappointment. It's not going anywhere, and he's losing vote after vote, and you know, the whole Congress is against him. And he seems to be coming round the corner, if I may use that comparison. He's getting towards the home straight, and there are all sorts of very strong and important foreign policy developments going on there, and Cuba being one of them. Fascinating. And all those details, you know, they'll be sorted out. But he's the one who's made it possible.
Yep.
John, there are still quite a few details, though, to be sorted out between Cuba and America, aren't there?
That's right. I mean, it's important to remember that just establishing diplomatic relations with a country doesn't mean that you're best bosom buddies.
Says the former ambassador to North Korea.
That's right. Yes, I speak from experience. But Cuba and the United States have any number of issues still to sort out, ranging from human rights, the way Cuba behaves on the international stage, and one immediate one, which will surface very quickly, restitution claims,
property yes.
in mm. Cuba. Mm. Apparently around 6,000 of these have been validated, a total of probably around $8 billion. It's a lot of money.
We don't have much time left, but John, since we did just mention your former posting in North Korea, and obviously the relations between Cuba and the US are slightly different from relations between North Korea and the UK, but can you just give us, what would your advice be to the first US ambassador who sets foot in Havana about how to build a relationship with a nation which has perhaps not always been best friends?
Smile a lot, make all the friends you can, but talk straight and talk hard from the off. Never let them think that you're soft.
That sounds like decent advice. Sebastian, when you look at this again from a European perspective, lots of European nations have had diplomatic relations with Cuba for some time, or have at least had sort of more amiable conversations with them.
One of those topics in European US dialogue, which we couldn't understand what it was all about. Maybe maybe it's hard for outsiders to understand. But seriously, I mean, the Americans got themselves into a complete corner, and it's really good to see that they've come out of it.
And if you can make friends with communist China in the 70s, then why not friends with communist
Madness.
Cuba?
Absolutely. I agree.
Just to end of this, it turns out that one of the property claims is the Chinese ambassador's residence in Havana, which was seized by Castro from a private family and was the Chinese now occupying. It'll be very interesting to see how they handle that one.
Okay, well, the Americans are going to help the Chinese to get it back for them.
Well, let's see.
We'll see. Okay, we'll leave it there. John Everard and Sebastian Borger, thank you both very much for joining us on Midori House. That's all we have time for on today's programme. Midori House was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Melcon Chuck Ligulin, and Paige Reynolds. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Chris Lord will be here for the next half hour. And then at 1900 Hours, it's Culture with Robert Bound. Midori House is back at the same time again tomorrow, 1800 London time, 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.